Hello, welcome to The Rest is History. This is the second part in a two-part special on the Watergate scandal. In the first part, top historian of modern America, Dominic Sambrook, futilely attempted to deal with the whole topic in a single episode. We went through the life of and career of Richard Nixon, and then we started on the countdown to the break into the Watergate complex to bug the Democratic is it party convention?
It's the Democratic National Committee.
Democratic Party headquarters.
Yeah, so they're basically Democratic Party headquarters.
Yeah. Okay. And so they've been the people doing that have been caught red-handed. Nixon has said we've got to try and cover it up. This will be the smoking gun. And now, Dominic, we can get back to the action and the countdown to what will be ultimately Nixon's resignation. But I'd like to kick off with a question from Stephen Wills, who asks, when did Nixon know the game was up and was there any chance he could have stayed? So that's the kind of the context for what over the next, what is it, year and a half, Nixon's attempt to stop this from destroying his presidency.
Well, first of all, I never really intended to do it in an hour. I was lying when I always thought it would take two episodes. I mean, if we could do two episodes on Thermopylae and Salamis without even mentioning Thermopylae and Salamis in the first episode, we could definitely do two episodes on Watergate. Now, when did Nixon know the game was up? He's not going to know the game is up for two more years. I mean, this is in the first episode, somebody asked, you know, why is Watergate so resonant? Why is everything? I mean, it's partly because it goes on so long. So, June 17th, 1972 is when the second burglary happens that is detected and the burglars are caught. So we talked about that last time. The 23rd of June, 1972, is when Nixon says to his chief of staff on tape, we have to basically abuse our powers, get the CIA to stop, get the FBI to stop the investigation, stop it going higher up. And then what happens, really interestingly, is kind of nothing for 6 months or more. So
In which time he wins the election.
He romps home in the election. And as I said last time, he celebrates by sitting on his own, listening to music in his sepulchral gloom and writing on a pad about what all the nasty things that people will say about him. So he's very bitter. He's actually really bitter after he's won this election.
You described him as a Shakespearean figure.
Yeah.
And I suppose that sense of, you know, absolute crushing success, victory, affirmation, while at the same time you've got this scandal, which is like a kind of little hint of dry rot in the wall.
That's
and it's going to slowly spread and spread and spread, and nothing he can do.
That's exactly right. One of his aides later on, John Dean, who we'll come to, describes it. He says to Nixon at one point, "There's a cancer on the presidency, and it's growing." And it's actually not a bad image. It's something very small, almost imperceptible at first, a nothing story. But as you say, it's going to grow and grow and grow and consume him. So November 1972, he wins this crushing landslide. January 1973, he is inaugurated for the second term. And they get peace in Vietnam, which they've been waiting for all this time. So it looks okay. And all this time, they have been paying off the burglars, by the way. They have given them, I think, something like $430,000 from...
Well, what, have the burglars not been arrested?
They've been arrested, but they need to be told... someone's got to pay their legal fees. These are not rich men. So someone has...
Right, and also, are they being paid to
they're being basically paid about, to keep quiet. Loss of... they're described as loss of earnings. Because loss of earnings through being in prison. Yes, exactly right. But in January 1973, so at the same time that Nixon is having these tremendous triumphs, they are convicted, obviously, because they're caught red-handed. And they're going to be sentenced in March 1973. So the question for Nixon is, if they keep quiet, and if nobody really digs into this, he can probably get away with it. But all it takes is one of them to break, or all it takes is somebody to start really following the money and so on, and he'll be in trouble. Now, the Washington Post, Carl Bernstein, rather, and Bob Woodward have been writing about following the money trail. They have an informant in the FBI called Deep Throat, who turns out to be the...
Okay, I think we've got a question.
Oh, very good.
Can somebody ask who came up with the name Deep Throat?
I don't actually know who came up with it. I did know, but I've forgotten. So Deep Throat is a porn film from the early 1970s.
Yeah.
And the guy is Mark Felt. He's the deputy FBI director. He's not a friend of the White House. The funny thing is, actually, there's this huge sort of hullabaloo when it turned out to be him. But actually, the Nixon White House had always known he was leaking to the press. So it's actually not that great a story. There's all this stuff that Woodward and Bernstein kind of rather ham up in their book about how they signalled to him with flower pots on windowsills and kind of ringed.
I mean, that's very much the sense you get from all the president's
men. Yeah, from all the president's men. But actually, the Woodward and Bernstein thing is not the thing that brings Nixon down at all. What brings him down, you could arguably, the moment, is, well, here we go. It's a period of two, three days, really, in March 1973. So on the 21st of March, the White House counsel, that's the White House lawyer, a man called John Dean, who's a young, clean-cut kind of Republican, a classic kind of party political hack, mm-hmm. who's basically, you know, worked his way up and got his job. He goes in, he's been handling the cover-up for Nixon. And he goes in and he says this thing about there's a cancer on the presidency. He says basically a lot of people have perjured themselves, saying they don't know anything, they don't know where it goes. And we're going to run into trouble because soon the burglars are going to be sent to prison. We're going to have to find more money for them and possibly money for other people if this goes up the chain. And there's this dreadful conversation again on tape. Nixon says, how much do you need? And Dean says, we'll need $1 million in cash. Very Austin Powers. And Nixon says,
$1 million.
He says, $1 million. I know where that can be gotten. Which is kind of very incriminating. So at that point, they have the first conversation. How far, who are we going to lose? We're going to, oh, we'll lose him and him and him. And at that moment, John Dean, this White House lawyer, can feel the kind of chill on the back of his neck because he thinks, well, I've been the guy who's orchestrating this cover-up.
Yes, yes.
Maybe they're going to come for me. And this is actually where the social mix of the Nixon White House, I think, is really interesting and important. Because I said in the previous episode, lots of these people are outsiders and self-made men. They have a lot to lose and no real way back if it goes wrong. They're not members of boarding school old boys groups, gentlemen's clubs. They're not part of the Washington kind of establishment. So if they go down, there's no ladder out for them. And that's why there's no sense of kind of solidarity among them, I think, which there might
have
been.
There is a question.
Yeah.
There's a question from the Church Mouse. Could Nixon have survived if it had been handled differently, e.g. the Trump method of hanging others out to dry but denying Nixon knew about it instead of trying to cover it
up? This is exactly what they do, Tom. This is exactly what their plan is. So that's the 21st of March. The next day, Nixon sends Dean to Camp David. And he says, I think what you should do is write a report for me about everything you know about the cover-up. Now, at that point, when the president tells you to do that, you kind of think, oh, that doesn't sound very good. Because does he want me to incriminate myself? Does he want me to lie about what's going on here? The very day after that, the 23rd of March, the judge is sentencing the burglars. And the judge gets up in court and he says, publicly, in open court in front of the press, he says, I've been handed a letter by one of the burglars, James McCord. And he reads out the letter. The letter says, we've been put under political pressure from the start. This was never a CIA operation. That's not true. People have perjured themselves in this investigation. And other powerful people knew about this and were behind it. And you can imagine the report is that
hubbub in court.
Yeah, it's that classic scene of like Hollywood
rhubarb, rhubarb, rhubarb.
Right, running people,
rushing off for the phone.
They are rushing, but they literally are rushing for the phone.
Yes,
this is just absolutely unbelievable. So then things start to unravel in a really interesting way. So the 6th of April, so a little bit, just a couple of weeks later, John Dean, Nixon's White House lawyer, decides, I need a lawyer of my own to represent me. And behind Nixon's back, he starts talking to a Senate committee that has been set up to look at campaign irregularities in 1972, called the Irvin Committee. So he starts talking to them and he starts talking to the prosecutors. So we're in April 1973. Nixon's first term has only really just started, but already things are starting to unravel. And throughout the course of this month, there was a series of meetings, Nixon and his aides, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Dean, they're kind of sitting around saying, how are we going to stop this? You know, who's going to take the fall? And with each meeting, it becomes more and more obvious that of those four men, three of them are going down. And the only question is whether they're going to take Nixon with them.
So it's like the end of Succession.
It is. Have you seen Succession? It's very Succession-like, actually. Yeah. It's very Succession-like, except Nixon is much more shambolic and ham-fisted than kind of Brian, what's his name? Logan Roy. Logan Roy. I love Logan Roy. Anyway, by the end of April, Nixon now knows that Dean is talking to the prosecutors and all this sort of thing, and he thinks the only way I can deal with this is to get rid of all of them, the lot, basically my closest aides. And there are these incredibly kind of tear-stained conversations almost, where Nixon says to...
So if it's like a cancer, this is full operation, amputation.
They've all got to go. I didn't know anything, but they knew everything. It was nothing to do with me. So they all go. We talked about Nixon and Quakerism in our last episode. Haldeman says this is the only time he and Nixon ever physically touched. So Quakers, don't approve of excessive physical contact. And Nixon only ever shook hands with Haldeman after he'd basically fired him. He sort of said, "Oh, Bob, you're a great man. I'll miss you," and shakes his hand. And is very, Nixon's very Gordon Brown-like, Tom. I don't think that's an unfair comparison. I think he's like a sort of more, a sort of darker, more sinister version of Gordon
trickier.
Brown. Trickier. Yeah, trickier. Okay. Exactly. So at that point... Nixon's presidency has kind of been amputated. He's lost his key. He's only got Kissinger left, really, of the people he ever relied on. But Kissinger is desperate to kind of keep his distance from the Watergate issue now. Kissinger never knew.
Has Kissinger been embroiled in this?
No, he hasn't. Although he did, he used to pester Nixon to bug his own staff to find out who was leaking. But Kissinger wasn't involved in the campaign irregularities or anything like that at all. In some ways, Kissinger, certainly in foreign policy, is now just basically running the presidency, because Nixon is spending all his time sitting up late at night, sweating and staring into the darkness and in a sort of very, having these kind of interior Shakespearean monologues.
Yes. And Dominic, in terms of foreign policy,
1973
is quite a turbulent year, isn't it?
It is. So, well, we're going to come to this, Tom.
Is this all going on in the background?
There is. There's lots going on in the background. Are you thinking about the unravelling of the Ted Heath premiership? Is that what you're thinking about?
I think kind of energy crisis.
Yes, we're going to come to this. We will get very topical. We're going to come to this. You'll see. So we now get to the summer of 1973. So this scandal is now very big news. And I said earlier there was a Senate committee investigating it. So one of the great things about this story is that the focus keeps moving from arena to arena. So it now moves to the Senate committee hearings, the Irvin committee hearings, and they are held. They are on TV. They are in the networks cleared their schedules and put them where the daytime soaps would be. So it becomes a kind of soap opera in and of itself. 85% of Americans watched part of these hearings. I mean, that tells you just how the colossal impact of them. And
And is Nixon saying that this is all the cosmopolitan liberal elite?
Yeah, he is.
Out to get him.
Exactly. That they are bitter about the election. They've always hated him. He knew nothing about it. It's very unfortunate these things happen in the White House, but they had nothing to do with him. He would never...
And we've got a question from the McRae case. Nixon's misdemeanors aside, how much of Watergate was Congress getting its revenge for being sidelined over Vietnam and finally finding the chance to bare its teeth?
There's a huge amount of truth in that, actually. So there's this phenomenon called the imperial presidency that people talk about. Historians wrote about in the sort of 70s. They said the presidency has become more and more powerful since the Second World War and the Cold War and has accumulated power and taken it from Congress. And particularly after Vietnam, this is Congress's chance to reassert itself. And I think there's loads of truth in that. A lot of people in Congress are itching to take back power from the presidency. And they see the dirty tricks, the wiretaps and so on, and the surveillance as a sign of a presidency that has lost any sight of kind of constitutional responsibility. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really good question. Anyway, the hearings, there's two big moments. One is where John Dean, Nixon's old counsel, White House counsel, goes along on, and this is in June, and he says the president did know. He knew about the cover-up, and he says this live on television. He knew about it, and he was in on it from the start. And actually, it's a great sensation, but lots of people think Dean is a kind of a reptilian figure. So one columnist calls him a bottom-dwelling slug. And people sort of say...
not a very pleasant
Dean image. Is a very sort of slick, smarmy kind of Republican... operative, and some people distrust him. They say maybe he's lying. No, maybe Nixon didn't know. Maybe he's lying. But then the great revelation, a flunky called Alexander Butterfield goes along to be interviewed in July, and almost by sort of random chance, somebody says, there doesn't happen to be a taping system in the Oval Office, does there?
Oh, no. Yeah.
And he had decided, you know, beforehand, I won't tell them anything about tapes unless they ask. And if they ask me a direct question, I'm not going to perjure myself. And he says, oh, well, now you come to mention it. Yeah, there is. And at that point, of course, you know, another sort of slightly run for the phones sensation. Yes. Because now you can find the proof. You know, now you can find out one way or the other. So at this point...
So why had Nixon not destroyed the tapes?
Well, that's what lots of people said. Why the hell did he not? I mean, even after the revelation, some of Nixon, I think Alexander Haig, who was then Nixon's chief of staff after Haldeman, says, you know, I just said to him, get a massive pile of the tapes, put them on the White House lawn, pour a load of petrol over them and just set them alight. And then there's nothing they can do. But he's just paralyzed, I suppose. To destroy the tapes is an admission of guilt, right? And he doesn't want to give, because of...
So is there a sense in which Nixon's... I mean, it sounds an odd thing to ask, but is there still a kind of strain of the moral within Nixon that is struggling with his worst nature?
That's a good question.
Because if you're a complete criminal,
yeah,
obviously you're going to get rid of the incriminating evidence on you. I mean, the fact he doesn't...
Yes, I think that's a good point.
It seems
actually
a surprisingly moral thing to do.
Maybe to some extent he's not.
It suggests a respect for the law.
Yes. Well, he keeps fighting the law. I mean, why doesn't he do it? Oh, I think it's just he...
Paralyzed.
He's paralyzed by indecision.
Staring at the headlights.
Yeah. But the weird thing is this battle then goes on for months. So now is about the tapes. So now yet another sort of antagonist presents itself. Nixon has been forced to set up a special prosecutor. And it is, I mean, you talked about Kennedy being his worst nightmare in the last episode. The special prosecutor is, if you went into Richard Nixon's nightmares and you got somebody who would be, you know, just the ultimate bogeyman, you would find a man called Archibald Cox. Archibald Cox went to boarding school, an East Coast boarding school. He wears a bow tie. He went to Harvard, which, of course, poor old Dick Nixon didn't get to go to because his family was too poor. And he worked for the Kennedys. He was a Kennedy lawyer and he worked in the Kennedy White House. So he's the special prosecutor. And he says, I'd like to see the tapes. And Nixon says, no. And then you have this sort of months-long battle. And eventually Nixon comes up with this is the deludedness, Tom. He should have burned them, you're right. What he says is, I'll do a compromise with you. I will release the tapes, but I'll only release them to one man who's a senator from Mississippi called John Stennis, who's incredibly racist and reactionary and is also deaf. He says,
genius.
I'll release them to him and he can maybe make notes on them and tell you what's on the tapes. That's not really how evidence works in court.
No. I mean, it's still not quite as good as Jeremy Thorpe, but it's...
No. So,
it's getting there.
So Archibald Cox says, no, that's not good enough. You know, you need to give me all these tapes. Nixon says, if you ask me for the tapes again, because Archibald Cox is supposedly working for Nixon. This is the bizarre thing. Nixon says, if you give me them again, I'm going to sack you. Stop asking for my tapes. And Archibald Cox asks for the tapes again. So on the 20th of October 1973, Nixon says to his Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, fire Archibald Cox and shut down the prosecution, shut down the special prosecutor's office into Watergate. And Richardson says no. He resigns. Nixon gets his deputy on the phone, a man called William Ruckelshaus, and he says, fire Archibald Cox, shut down the special prosecution unit. And Ruckelshaus says no. He resigns. Finally, they come to the third man, who's a man called Robert Bork. He's got this sort of Mephistopheles kind of...
Oh, who becomes...
Reagan nominates him for the Supreme Court. And he doesn't get him. He's got this, partly because of this, because he's got this sort of Mephistopheles beard. He looks very sort of sinister. And he says, I'll fire him for you. So he fires Archibald Cox. The White House sends people to seal off the offices and to sort of seize the evidence that Archibald Cox has amassed, which looks kind of shocking. I mean, as a PR move, it is an utter unalloyed catastrophe that Nixon is basically sacking the person who's investigating him, trying to seal off his offices, take all his stuff and all this. Nixon's approval rating plummets to 17%, and he gets 500,000 telegrams, the highest in Western Union's history, of people saying, you're a fascist, you're trying to, you know, subvert the rule of law. And this is where your stuff about foreign policy comes in, Tom, because this is at precisely the moment that the Yom Kippur War is raging between Israel, Egypt and Syria, the war that is going to trigger the great OPEC oil shock and the energy crisis of late 1973. And at this very moment, American and Soviet ships are kind of steaming through the Mediterranean with supplies for their rival clients. So Nixon is...
So America is backing Israel.
Yeah, America is backing
Israel. Backing
exactly.
Arabs.
And there's a sense, you know, this is escalating towards something completely out of control. Nixon has gone mad and is consumed by Watergate. On the 24th of October, so 4 days after the so-called Saturday Night Massacre, when they tried to shut down the prosecution, the situation in the Middle East is so bad that Henry Kissinger, with a couple of other kind of Nixon officials, behind Nixon's back, puts America's nuclear forces on their highest alert, DEFCON 3. So blimey. It's a really serious thing. But Nixon is not even involved in that decision because he's spending all the time sweating, sleeping late, drinking, just in
swearing,
in an absolute kind of, in an absolute mess. So anyway, World War III doesn't happen. The reaction to this Nixon's move is so bad that he has to appoint another prosecutor, a guy called Leon Jaworski, who has working with him a certain Hillary Rodham, later Hillary Rodham Clinton. And finally, Nixon starts to release these tapes. So the first tranche of tapes comes out in November 1973, seven tapes, and one of them, the one for the 20th of June, right after the Watergate break-in, has an 18.5-minute, strange, inexplicable 18.5-minute gap on it. And everybody says, well, what's this gap? Nixon's chief of staff, Alexander Haig, says, the tape must have been erased by a sinister force, but I don't know what it is. And then Nixon's secretary, Rosemary Woods, says, I must have accidentally erased it by pressing the wrong button when I was leaning for the phone. And then basically the prosecutors make her do this thing which proves that she could only have erased it while reaching for the phone by doing this incredible acrobatics across the room. So basically it looks like Nixon erased it himself in a very shambolic way. Haig himself has said since he thinks Nixon listened to the tape and tried to destroy the whole tape, but made a mess of it because he was terrible with equipment. He didn't know, you know, he was the classic kind of dad who doesn't know kind of how the video recorder works. So there's this 18.5-minute gap, which looks pretty bad. But still, the president, he's still president. It's still lingering on. So anyone else would probably run away at this point or just, you know, go into a locked room with a revolver and a bottle of brandy or something. But Nixon is still there. He can't be killed. Keep going. They keep asking for more tapes. It gets to April 1974. Now Nixon says, well, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to give you the tapes. I'll give you transcripts. So he thinks if I give them loads, then there'll be so much. They just won't know what to do with it. He gives them 1,200 pages worth of conversations, but he has gone through them all, had his people go through them all and take out all the swearing. This is the Quaker again. So all the swearing has been taken out and replaced with expletive deleted. And the weird thing about that, I think a lot of people, historians have written about this, is that actually Nixon's language wasn't that bad. But because of his Quakerism, he got them to take out damn, you know, hell, all the... So
it's kind of, don't think of an elephant.
Right.
Oh, all the swear words are missing.
Yeah, exactly.
So everyone, yeah.
So
it's another example of the cover-up being worse.
It is, actually. This is a very good example. Yeah. Finally, the Supreme Court rules that he must surrender all the tapes. August 1974, he releases a load of tapes, and among them is the smoking gun conversation that we talked about at the end of the last episode, where he said to Haldeman, get the CIA to tell the FBI not to look into it. And with that, I mean, that he is sunk, because that shows that he knew about the cover-up from the very beginning, that he's lied about it ever since. There is no possible excuse. There is no way around it. The wheels of impeachment are already in motion. The House Judiciary Committee has voted to impeach him, and six Republicans on the committee have voted to impeach him. It's going to go to the Senate, clearly going to go to the Senate for a trial. Then you have these incredible scenes. So on the 7th of August, the Republican Party's congressional leaders go to see Nixon. They basically say, Mr. President, the game is up. You know, you're not going to win a trial. You're not even going to come close. You're damaging the Republican Party. You know, you've got to go. So then they go away, the Republican congressional leaders. And then there's this incredible scene, you know, very Hitler in his bunker. Nixon sits alone in the darkness. He listens to classical music, kind of staring into the night. Then he calls Henry Kissinger. And he says, Henry, I need you to come over. Kissinger comes over. And they sit together drinking brandy. Nixon starts crying. He sobs. And then he says, Henry, will you pray with me? And they get down on their knees together and they pray. And Nixon is crying. And by some accounts, Kissinger kind of holds him like a baby there in the White House study. And then you know what Nixon says when Kissinger finally leaves? Kissinger thinks this is excruciating, by the way. He's incredibly embarrassed. Mm-hmm. When they leave, the last thing Nixon says to him, please, Henry, he says, please don't ever tell anyone that I cried and that I was not strong.
And here we are talking
about... Yeah, and Kissinger tells everybody.
Okay.
Terrible, terrible behaviour.
Okay.
So then the 8th of August, he gives this resignation speech live on television. Then he sits up, he can't sleep. And then he actually comes to go on the 9th. And right at the beginning of the very first episode, what seems like a lifetime ago, I think it was Stefan Jensen asked, why is Watergate so resonant compared with other scandals? It's because the melodrama is greater. So the 9th of August.
And punctuated, I guess, by kind of certain points that people can tune in to find out what's
exactly
going to happen.
Exactly. So he assembles all the White House staff, his family. He comes out on this platform and he gives a farewell speech in which he breaks down again and again. He hasn't slept for days. He just starts rambling. He talks about his father, a little man, they would have called him, a kind of common man. He talks about his mother, who lost two sons. She was a saint, he says. She was a saint. He reads from Theodore Roosevelt's memoir about when his wife died, comparing himself basically to somebody who's been bereaved. And then he gives this... I know lots of people will laugh at me about this. I always find very moving. He says, his final words, virtually his final words, he says, you know, the greatness comes and you're really tested when you take some knocks, some disappointment, when sadness comes, because only if you've been in the deepest valley can you know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. Very
wow.
Sort of Shakespearean.
Wow. Very Shakespearean.
And then he goes off to the helicopter, the V signs... flies off to California, and that's the end. That's
okay.
Farewell
and
to Nixon.
I think it's farewell to the first part of this second episode.
This is only the first part. Then, oh my god, I thought you were going to say this.
Yeah, it is. No. So when we come back, and I know this is going to be agony for you, but yeah. I think we've got to compress quite a lot. We need to look at how he gets his pardon and the long term effects of the scandal, whether it had long term effects. So we will see you back after the break.
See you after the break.
Hello, welcome back to the second part of our Watergate-themed series on The Rest is History. Nixon has resigned. He's flown off in his helicopter to California. Dominic, we have a counterfactual here from Roy Nelly.
Yeah.
And he asks, how does US political history play out in a world where Ford doesn't pardon Nixon?
Okay.
Presumably Ford is easily re-elected and no Ronald Reagan. So Gerald Ford is the vice president.
Yeah,
under Nixon, therefore automatically succeeds him as president, and he pardons Nixon. What happens if he doesn't?
He was always going to pardon Nixon. I don't think there's a scenario in which he doesn't pardon Nixon. I like Gerald Ford, the only president, of course, to have appeared in a Pink Panther film, in Pink Panther Strikes Again.
really? Big golfer, wasn't he?
He was. He was very sport. Weirdly, everyone remembers him for falling over. But actually, he's the most athletic president in American history. He's a very, very good sportsman. I like Gerald Ford a lot, actually. He used to go on holiday, of course, with Jim Callahan. So Ford pardons Nixon a month after Nixon leaves. He has to pardon him. Almost everybody around him says, we cannot have Nixon's trial hanging over your presidency. It will defeat everything you want to do. It will completely torpedo any possibility you have of winning re-election. Election. And legal advisors also say Nixon, if he's convicted, he will almost certainly appeal, and he will probably have reasonable grounds, because he will be able to say it was impossible for him to have a fair trial because he's been prejudged in the press, and because there'll be no possible juror who is unaware of the scandal. So it will be very difficult. Nixon's also in atrocious health. So Nixon has phlebitis in his leg, which he's allowed to get worse and worse in the course of 1974. A lot of people think that Nixon basically had a suicide wish at this point. So he's also getting advice from people who know Nixon that say Nixon may well kill himself if you allow him to go to trial, if you don't pardon him. Ford also is told, has got legal advice, that the acceptance of a pardon carries an imputation of guilt.
And what is Ford's relationship with Nixon? I mean, had they got on?
No, they weren't very close. So Ford wasn't actually Nixon's first vice president. Nixon's first vice president was a man called Spiro Agnew, who'd resigned because he'd been taking kind of kickbacks when he was governor of Maryland.
He hated hippies.
Spiro Agnew is a great... I love Spiro Agnew. He's like a sort of Daily Express columnist.
Yes.
he goes around, he talks about the nattering nabobs.
Even worse than Daily Mail ones.
Nattering nabobs of negativism. I always like his, he attacked he talked about you, Tom. He said liberals were, an effete core of impudent snobs who characterised themselves as intellectuals.
Brilliant. That's me to a T.
Yeah. Anyway, so Ford probably was always...
So Ford pardons him.
Yeah.
Ford pardons him. Nixon doesn't die.
Yeah.
He talks to David Frost. David Frost gets it. Yeah. So that's Watergate.
Yeah.
But I think that we've had a lot of questions about the impact and why it had this resonance. So just for example, Barry Grogan, why does Watergate continue to be so famous, have such staying power? There have been much more serious presidential scandals such as Iran-Contra or Trump's actions before and on January the 6th. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would, actually. I think Iran-Contra, certainly. Reagan was running an illegal foreign policy that had been basically explicitly banned by Congress, giving aid to the Contras in Nicaragua. What is he doing? He's secretly trading arms for hostages. It's much more serious than Watergate, which is basically a caper. I mean, Watergate really is a caper, a ludicrous, the bugging of the Democratic National Committee is not good. It breaks the kind of democratic norms, but it's not the end of the world. It certainly doesn't compare with the Trump supporters storming the Capitol. That's absolutely, I mean, they're not in the same league.
So obviously, I guess the impact of Watergate on America's standing in the world is not positive. It's not good for America, but couldn't you argue that actually it shows how important the rule of law is?
Yeah, of course you could.
That something so small can bring down, you know, the president of the United States.
You could argue, Tom,
and you can imagine this kind of thing going on, you know, in other countries, and nobody would bat an eyelid.
Isn't Nicolas Sarkozy just been sentenced to prison in France?
All kinds of stuff.
I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, you could argue, I think it would be a reasonable argument, actually, that it reflects well on American politics, that the system works, the president has been...
Is not above the law.
Is not above the law. He's been party to wrongdoing. He's tried to cover it up, and he's been caught, and he has been forced from office. I mean, I think you could absolutely make that argument. I think one reason it's so resonant... Going back to that first episode we did, it happens in the context of the late 1960s, Vietnam, a general loss of trust, an economic downturn, a crisis of authority generally, and it feels like part of a bigger story. I mean, scandals always resonate. We talked about this in the Thorpe episode. Why do scandals resonate? They resonate if they express they're seen as symptoms of a wider disease, if they are kind of windows into a bigger story. And Watergate is exactly one of those.
perhaps also if they do have a slight element of the comic,
yes,
that can kind of hook people, so that you have all the drama and the tension, but there is also the slight element of slapstick.
Although I don't think that what strikes us now, the slapstick elements, I think at the time a lot of Americans didn't find it funny. I think they were genuinely shocked about the swearing in the Oval Office and about the kind of characters that Nixon was associated with. I mean, they didn't view it as we do in our sort of cynical, flippant way. They thought,
you
know, this is... Because they really venerated the presidency. I mean, I don't think that's
So Dominic.
Yeah.
So that leads on to another question from Duncan Simpson. We now live in a society where there is constant scandal in the news and the proven lies from our leaders are met with very little uproar. How much did Watergate change the idea of faith in our leaders and an expectation of them being good people?
Yeah, I think it definitely damaged Americans' faith in the presidency. I mean, there's a sort of, that's one reason they turned to Reagan actually in 1980. I think there's a thirst for somebody who, you know, will restore, as people see it, the grandeur, the kind of regal magnificence of the presidency.
And is that why Reagan is able to weather the Iran-Contra scandal?
I think absolutely. Because there's
people just didn't want it.
There's no appetite for it.
They just didn't want it. Yeah.
But then it does, you see, then you do have the Clinton impeachment in the 1990s.
And that is seen as kind of, I mean, certainly Democrats see that as Republicans deliberately trying to get revenge for Watergate.
They absolutely do. Because people point to the fact that Hillary Clinton had been working for the special prosecution team in 1974. Although, of course, I always think with the Clinton impeachment, you know, everybody's for 10, 15 years, people said, it's nothing, it's a storm in a teacup, you know, it's just a Republican concocted. And now I think people post kind of Me Too, don't you think people look at that Clinton and Lewinsky and think, that was actually pretty shabby?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard to take the Republicans of that period.
Seriously, you're right. Yeah.
Kind of woke gender warriors.
Yeah.
I don't think that was motivating them.
That's very true. Especially as most of them ended up, you know, being brought down by the impeachment business as well.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, I think, but one thing that I do think is you could argue a dangerous legacy of Watergate is the tendency to kind of criminalize presidential politics. So, you know, America has had a lot of impeachments now compared with the previous 100 years or so.
Well, Dominic, do you remember that the very first episode we recorded that in the end didn't go out because we weren't very good on
it? Where we just lectured nothing's changed.
We did a comparison between ancient Rome and modern America.
We already recorded it. We did put it out.
One of the things that happens in ancient Rome is that the law becomes a weapon in kind of political rivalries. And the chance to prosecute and drag down a rival kind of contributes to the turbulence of the late Roman Republic.
Yeah.
And would you see the same thing happening?
Undoubtedly. Undoubtedly, actually. And it's interesting because once you get to the Trump impeachment, that, unlike the Nixon impeachment, which obviously didn't reach its culmination, the Trump impeachment, certainly the first one, was absolutely perceived in terms of party politics, wasn't it? I mean, nobody, it divided on partisan lines, except for Mitt Romney, I think. And nobody, there was no sort of sense of the rule of law being a standard above petty partisan politics, which I think in 1974.
I mean, it was basically, you know, we've got to stand up to Russia or we've got to stand up to China.
Yeah.
And so it was also a kind of policy divide, wasn't it?
Well, I suppose. But it was also just purely seen as a referendum on, do you support Trump or do you not support him?
Okay, so Stefan Jensen, friend of the show, but is being a little bit greedy here. I'm not going to deny, because this is his second question.
Yeah, but in two episodes, though. I mean...
All right. But it's a good question, so we'll forgive him. Would Trump have been impeached if he did the exact same thing today? To what extent have cross-partisan norms and trust been eroded to the point that there is almost no limit to what a party will accept from their president?
That is,
or I suppose, conversely, to what an opposition will do to bring down a president. Yeah.
That's a really excellent and actually slightly disturbing question, because I think Stefan's implication is probably right, that Trump certainly would have said, everybody does it, you know, fake news, the media, how many Republicans would have fallen into line behind him? Well, I think you just look at the he was not convicted in the second impeachment after the storming of the Capitol. I mean, where, if you won't if you won't convict him for that, you'll never convict him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's your answer, I think, isn't it? That so I think any president, I'm sure it probably works the other way around as well, by the way. Once you have a hyper-partisan political environment, then it becomes impossible to appeal to some sort of sense of the rule of law that transcends politics.
Well, it's kind of loser's consent has basically gone in America, hasn't it? I mean, would that be too much of an exaggeration?
No, I think...
Not entirely, obviously.
And I think Clinton is where you saw that. There were lots of Republicans who viewed Clinton as an illegitimate president, even though he'd won the 92 election fair and square. He was re-elected in 96. But there were a lot of people who just thought, we have to get him fair means or foul.
Go on. So there's an absolute train of within American politics that you can see. But there's also, and this is again a great question from Bartman 1981. To what extent have the many films on Nixon and Watergate influenced and perhaps misinformed the public perception on the subject? And I would like to expand that to say, to what extent has the idea of paranoia, of conspiracy, of covers up that has become a massive part of popular American culture, to what extent do you think that has corroded the norms of American democracy?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Tom. I think they probably it has corroded it, undoubtedly. The idea of the corrupt establishment, sinister forces, all that stuff. I mean, that's already there before Watergate happens. It's kind of in the air. There's a whole load of films from the early 70s. There's obviously All the President's Men. There's a film called The Conversation. I think that's 1972. That's about taping. Gene Hackman. There's a film called The Parallax View about assassinations, again 1974. And there is this sort of sense of American cinema in the early 70s being very paranoid and all about conspiracies and stuff. Yes, of course, I think it probably is damaging. It reflects a general loss of faith in authority that had a lot to do with Vietnam. But obviously, as we now know, because we have it in Britain, everywhere in the Western world has it, goes beyond that. But don't you think it's damaging? I think, of course, I mean, you and I can joke about it in a sort of flippant way and say, oh, we love conspiracy theory films. But they do matter. I mean, they do affect the way people think about politics.
Well, I was kind of thinking that the backdrop to the Clinton impeachment was X-Files.
Yeah.
Which ostensibly was about aliens, but actually was about kind of cover-ups and that you can't trust the government and that nothing is true. And that actually that did kind of provide... its popularity was obviously buying into a sense that you can't trust anybody in government.
Yeah. And that's always been there in America to some extent, because America's obviously founded on a distrust of government, i.e. of George III, and the anti-government spirit. What the historian Richard Hofstadter famously called the paranoid style in American politics. The sense that that's always been there. Initially it was Catholics out to get them, and then it was communists.
Does that answer the question then of why Watergate has had this kind of massive impact? Is that actually it kind of goes with the grain of what quite a lot of people in the United States kind of suspected about the doings of government?
Yes, I suppose so. And I suppose one thing that's interesting about the American reaction to it is, had it happened in France, there'd have been an awful lot of shrugging and people sort of saying, "Bof, well... that's what politicians do," I mean, French politics is incredibly corrupt, right? I mean, Sarkozy, Chirac, Mitterrand, list as long as your arm. But there is also that kind of, what the Quaker and Richard Nixon would have recognized, that kind of sense of, we're a clean living, sober, Protestant, godly people, and we're a shining city on a hill. Lots of people said this during Watergate. We should be the example to the world. We're America. We don't do this.
This isn't America.
Yeah. Yes. As everybody said after the Capitol insurrection, didn't they? This is not America. We're like, well, it kind of is.
Kind of is now. Yes. Okay. Well, coming to the close, but let's just turn it back to Nixon himself.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of question that's been shadowing the entire both episodes, really. Which is, how do you think he would be judged had Watergate not tripped him up? Would he be remembered as an impressive president?
I think he would, actually.
And do you think that Watergate has kind of tarnish the memory of the achievements that he could clock up.
Because
he's seen as a kind of evil person. I mean, Tricky Dicky.
Yeah.
He's you know, the Hunter S. Thompson that we began episode one with. You know, that he is a kind of, you know, a moral turd floating in the sewer.
Right.
I mean,
that's very harsh.
Very strong.
I think that's very, yes. I think people, but there's also a comic sense to Nixon, isn't there? I mean, people have Nixon on T-shirts, or they have kind of the very image of Nixon with his kind of jowly face.
Yeah.
Bowling or something is seen as amusing and kind of retro.
Always looks funny on The Simpsons.
Yeah, exactly. And he was on he was often on a show called Futurama, kind of Simpsons type show. Yeah, I think Nixon was a fascinating and creative president, governing in troubled times. He was actually much more liberal often than he's given credit for, and in terms of foreign policy, you know, had tremendous achievements, détente and so on, going to Moscow. Going
so the comparison of him to Trump.
Oh, it's ridiculous. The other thing about Nixon, so I said that we talked in the first episode how I taught this course when I was an academic at Sheffield. It ran all year and we met for 4 hours a week and we went through Nixon's whole career and Watergate. We did it in enormous detail.
So this is kind of typical Marxist academics,
right?
Undermining decent, right thinking ways of understanding.
And history. I have to say, the students. ended it incredibly sympathetic to Nixon. And it wasn't just my brainwashing. It's one of them who actually went on to become...
Well, he is a tragic hero.
Yeah, one of them who went on to become a historian himself, and I think he's at Nottingham, said to me... I can remember him saying in the seminar, he said, the thing about Nixon is, as a man, when you look at Nixon, you kind of look, you see yourself. All his anxieties are the anxieties of kind of masculinity, that you're kind of... You know, there are people having more fun than you. The girls aren't looking at you. That the part,
the sweat gathering under
you. Exactly. You've forgotten to put your deodorant on. You've got the wrong shoes. You know, you don't really know how to behave. You don't know what difference between Burgundy and Bordeaux. You've worked so hard to get here. You know, you've worked harder than anybody else. And yet they will always look down on you and sneer at you.
Trying to cover up that parking ticket. Spiral.
But exactly, the knowledge at the back of your mind, the nagging fear, that terrible thing you did, which seemed so small at the time, is going to bring you down. I think there's something so sort of empathetic in Nixon. And if you can't see yourself in Nixon, there's something wrong with you. That's
okay, well, I think that's an amazing note on which to end. Are you like Nixon? If you're not, there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
Top historian of the modern United States, Dominic Sandbrook, has spoken. And on that note, we will bid you farewell.
Farewell.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.